Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The conventional image of a person with an eating disorder is that of a white, middle-class teenage girl or woman. In fact, eating disorders are also found in boys and men and also in communities of color and in LGBTQ populations. And experts say because the perception persists of the eating disorder as a so-called white girl's disease, this debilitating form of mental illness often goes unrecognized in minority communities and untreated by members of the medical profession. Nicole Weaver experienced this firsthand. She is celebrity writer for The Cheat Sheet, and as an African-American girl growing up, developed an eating disorder. She was able to overcome it, but joins us for the first part of the hour to tell us of this difficult period in her life. Nicole, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And in studio with us for the full hour, Samantha DeCaro is Assistant Clinical Director at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia. Hello, Samantha.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Rebecca Peebles is Adolescent Medicine Specialist and Co-Director of the Eating Disorder Assessment and Treatment Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Good to have you with us, Rebecca.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me as well.
And also, we're taking calls and comments. 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. So, Nicole, let's get to your story first. You say that even as a young girl, you were a picky eater. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, in grade school and everything, I think it's quite normal for kids to just be very picky. But for me, it was sort of different because my doctors would say I was underweight, so I'd have to be basically forced to stay at the table to finish my meals. And it kind of persists my weird relationship with food into high school, where then I was being much more restrictive, skipping meals, over-exercising. And, yeah, as a black girl, that's not really talked about in our community. My parents kind of realized something was going on, and I feel like that started being noticeable to me because every day it became a question of what did I eat. I don't feel like that's really normal small talk.
Yeah.
And then, just finally one day when I was asked again by my mother, like, what did you eat today? And the answer that I gave was just not sufficient. It was obvious that I was skipping meals. Her response was just, black girls don't do that. You just don't see it in the media at all that black girls have eating disorders. Usually we are curvier and, like, prouder. There's Beyonce that's, like, a symbol of beauty. But, yeah, that's just not where my mental health was. And, yeah, eating disorders is a mental health issue, and it's just, like, not talked about in our community. So the response was different.
So Nicole, when your mom said to you, you know, black girls don't have eating disorders, what do you remember thinking?
I remember thinking relief and disappointment. Relief because finally someone's noticing what's happening to me. It wasn't really something I was allowing myself to realize. I kind of didn't want to. I mean, we see it all the time in media of just any woman. We talk about our size all the time, and we're learned to talk negatively about ourselves, and that's kind of how women relate to each other. We feel like, oh, if an actress talks about eating French fries and stuff like that, like, that's relatable, but also, like, hating our own bodies. So, but yeah, so I felt relief that someone's pointing out what's happening and how it's wrong, but then I felt disappointment because it's like, but you're not allowed that pain, you know? Like, the pain that black women have that's talked about in the media is racism. So you don't get to feel bad about your body. You have so many other things to worry about. And, yeah, it's something, black parenting, there's many other things that you have to prepare your kid for,
yeah,
which is trying to be twice as good as everyone else when it comes to grades. And you have to portray yourself a certain way to be respectable in the workplace one day. You don't have parents really talking about, but does your kid have a good body image? And let's talk about mental health and depression. It's just, any kind of mental illness right now. It's just not talked about, especially eating disorders.
Well, and Nicole, we're also going to just this note, you know, as we go through the conversation this hour, we'll also look at similar perceptions in not only the African-American community, but the Latino communities as well, mm-hmm. and Asian communities and LGBTQ populations. But back to your story, you know, without getting too personal, give us a sense of perhaps how you manage your food and your exercise when you were going through this.
Right. Yes. So I was skipping meals pretty regularly. It was kind of like a weird, dieting culture is so normal in our society. We talk about diets all the time and what actors and celebrities are doing to stay thin. So it's kind of normal to diet. But then I was like going further with it and just seeing how long I can go without eating and like feeling pride for how long I was going without. And then just the exercise. I was active in high school as part of soccer. And I told myself that I was preparing for the season by just going to see how long I could run. But I know what I was doing was not normal. Like, there's no reason to run as long as I was.
And I'm sure we're going to get some insight from some Samantha DeCaro and Rebecca Peebles on that in just a moment. Mm-hmm. But what was the turning point for you, Nicole?
Turning point, I think, was college. I think there was just there's so many changes I had to like go through, which everyone goes through when it comes to college. I think my mentality and like my stressors were different. I think my identity of being skinny and how that was such a big part of my identity when I was younger and what so many people praised me for, like that was no longer a thing in college. It was more about studying and I wanted to become a writer. So I don't know. I think my focus was different and therefore I stopped focusing so much on weight. And I'm not like, I believe that you should try and get professional help if you need to. That's just not part of my journey. But I'm not also saying that I'm cured or whatever. I feel like an eating disorder is an ongoing journey to recovery. And I feel like even to this day, like there's some stumbles, but it's an ongoing journey.
Well, quick question for you, Nicole. I know you were seeing a physician, you know, on and off, you know, as you're growing up. Did your personal physician at any point say to you as an African-American young woman, I think you might have an eating disorder?
No. It was more so I was underweight. It wasn't anything extreme to like what you would see on television, which I think is also kind of harmful that not only like media shows white women being the ones having an eating disorder, but an eating disorder might be like not as big of a problem unless you get into the hospital, which is not true. And yes, so I was underweight, but it was only still like 10 pounds. So they're like, oh, just letting you know, like, this is your healthy weight. And I was under. So someone who was sick and who still had the mentality of less is better, I felt like I was overachieving rather than seeing, no, being underweight is actually unhealthy. Doctors didn't really tell me that. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like some doctors might be too focused on overweight people. And even if they are healthy, they'll tell them, well, you need to lose weight, just because in society we see that body type as being unhealthy. But underweight is unhealthy too. And I kind of feel like I might have been a little cheated by someone not telling me that what I was probably doing was a bad sign. But yeah.
So one more quick question, because I know you're only with us for a few minutes, Nicole. How do you feel about your body image today? Are you comfortable with who you are?
I mean, like I said, it's a very up and down. For a while, I had to stop working out and just stop dieting. And I feel like for someone who had an eating disorder, it's like an extreme. So I kind of had to go to the other extreme where it's like, don't weigh yourself, don't exercise for a while, just eat what you want, like, and then go back to balance. I feel like I'm going back to finding my balance. I work out when I want to work out. I try to not, like, weigh myself. It's not about that. It's about how I feel. And I try to focus on just focusing on what my body can do. I am happy if I can do 10 jumping jacks in a row rather than can I fit into whatever size dress. I'm trying to learn that I need to love my body for what it can do, what it does for me, and not the size of it.
Oh, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate the time and you giving us a glimpse into your life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Nicole Weaver is a celebrity writer for The Cheat Sheet. And again, as a young African-American girl growing up, developed an eating disorder. And she was able to share some of her story with us. So Rebecca Peebles and Samantha DiCaro, she was fortunate in that she was able to pull herself pretty much out of a potentially difficult, dangerous situation. But I imagine your medical attention is critical for many, if not most, eating disorder cases. Rebecca?
Yes, definitely. They have severe medical complications that can be a real problem. Many of the patients that present to our program do require medical stabilization in a hospital setting. I think that, you know, they affect the heart, they affect the liver, they affect bones, every organ system. So it's definitely pretty severe. That said, you know, Nicole obviously shows the resilience of many women out there and men and people of all ethnicities and socioeconomic strata and everything. So they're, you know, I think most patients, most people with eating disorders actually never get care. And well, that's a sad thing.
And especially, again, in this research that I was taking a look at, people who happen to be in minority populations. And Samantha DiCaro, you know, Nicole talked about seeing her physician and was told that she was underweight. But it doesn't sound as if she was ever kind of taken in a direction of determining whether she had an eating disorder. Did you pick up on that? And is that fairly common in the medical community?
Yes, I definitely picked up on that. And I think it's really unfortunate because early detection and early intervention can really make a big difference with eating disorders. And I think that physicians, mental health professionals aren't always asking the right questions. And I think oftentimes they're relying on what someone looks like to make a quick diagnosis or assessment. And the reality is, I think that's part of our own bias as clinicians and physicians that we need to look at so that when we have someone in front of us, we don't discount food, body. We're asking the questions that need to be asked so we can really get to the root of what's going on.
Well, it's also culture, too. And I know psychologist Gail Brooks, who also works with Renfrew, was quoted in a publication as saying that, you know, traditionally African-American women were less likely to feel the same pressures as white women to be thin. Curvy African-American women were celebrated, is what she wrote. So clinically, it was thought that they were somehow immune to eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And is that something that needs to be added to a physician's repertoire?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that there's some truth in the fact that with African-Americans, and again, I'm speaking from a place of white privilege. Yeah. I just want to acknowledge that. So there are likely blind spots. But, you know, in the African-American culture, the culture of origin, I think that there is a different sort of acceptance of body image, and a larger body image can be seen as more attractive. But if you live in American and Western culture, we're not immune to the pervasive thin ideal, which we're bombarded with.
We'll also be talking about other different communities affected by eating disorders. Stay with us. Radio Times continues. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are taking a look at eating disorders this hour, which are not restricted to white, suburban, middle-class teen girls. That's the popular perception. There are large populations of various groups, African-American, Latino, LGBTQ, and of course, boys and men who also experience eating disorders. And quite often in these populations, debilitating mental illness is not diagnosed. In studio with for the rest of the hour, we have Samantha DiCaro, who is Assistant Clinical Director at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia, and also Rebecca Peebles, Adolescent Medicine Specialist and Co-Director of the Eating Disorder Assessment and Treatment Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And again, lines are open, 888-477-9499. You can also send us a tweet if you like at WHYY Radio Times. And we're going to get to the calls in just a moment, but a quick question, Rebecca. Do cultural factors, in your experience, make any one group more susceptible to, say, a certain type of eating disorder than others?
You know, I actually haven't noticed cultural factors varying that much enough that it changes the incidence. I'm sure there would be people that disagree with me, but I think the more state of the art sort of evidence leads us to think that these are really brain disorders, and that they occur in people with neurobiologic and genetic vulnerabilities toward being very driven, toward sometimes being rigid about certain selections, being more anxious. Often co-occurring with OCD, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that those things can cross all categories of people in this country, you know, and there are tons of teens that struggle with those things and that have parents that have struggled with those things. And that really can lead you to be more vulnerable to societal messages.
Why does it seem as if teens across the board are affected by eating disorders more than, say, older women and men?
I don't know that we know the answer to that, but there is a huge emerging literature of women that get eating disorders in their 30s to 40s and in geriatric subpopulations and things like that. So
the demographic is changing?
Or we've understudied it, just like there's been this huge selection bias in that we've really only studied for a long, long time people who were white, affluent, teenage females or mid-20s kind of thing. And now that we're sort of looking at it in a broader perspective, we're finding that they're pretty common everywhere. So I don't know what you think, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that there are so many segments of the population that are underrepresented in the research and who also have access to treatment. And so when you see the same types of people coming in for treatment, it just kind of perpetuates this myth that this is an urban, suburban, white girl disease. And it's not really true. And I think we've really broadened our perspective and we're realizing, yes, there's this genetic personality component sort of comes together as a perfect storm with culture or stressors, the thin ideal, whatever it may be, and an eating disorder is born and maintained. It's hard to say because I think the research has been unfair and we're not really able to tell.
All right, let's get to those phones. We've got Lisa in Morristown. Welcome to Radio Times, Lisa.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hello?
Hello. Yes, you're live with us on Radio Times.
Here.
I'm not sure Lisa can hear us. Can you hear us now, Lisa?
I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, listen, welcome to Radio Times. And
thank you so much.
So what are you thinking, Lisa?
Well, I'm really pleased that you guys are discussing this topic today because it's near and dear to my heart. I was suffering from an eating disorder. My mom really felt that I was, and took me to a reputable hospital in northern New Jersey, and the head of the eating disorder there told me that I couldn't have an eating disorder because black girls didn't get eating disorders. Hmm. This allowed me to remain in my sickness for the next 4 years, when, again, my mother took me to a different hospital in central southern New Jersey, which I will mention, Somerset Medical Center, for an evaluation. I fully expected to leave with the same non-diagnosis, and they did not let me leave and admitted me to the eating disorder unit that day. Hmm. It was very difficult to get the treatment paid for. It was difficult to find a certified eating disorder unit, and I'm thankful that my mother is so persistent that she allowed me to she was able to research and help me to get over the eating disorder.
So, Lisa, what difference did that 4 years make in your life?
Well, I'm sure as you can speak to, eating disorders tend to go along with other mental illnesses like depression. So it was very traumatic on my body. It was traumatic on my mind. I actually developed pancreatitis, which is another side effect associated with bulimia more so than anorexia. And just, you know, my skin, my hair, not getting the nutrients that I needed. It was hard to study consistently. I was in college at the time. And it was just very, and it was also very isolating.
And why was it isolating?
Well, because I went to an HBCU, this is historically black college, and it was not talked about on campus. And so I was really alone. And when the first doctor told me, well, black girls don't get an eating disorder, I thought, well, you know, I am just an anomaly. And so it was very, very isolating.
Yeah. Well, and one of the focuses of the show is that really you and other women and young girls like you and boys, of course, too, are not anomalies, that eating disorders cross different populations. So how are you feeling today?
I still struggle with eating, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. You know, it's all, I like to explain it to people that when you are a drug addict, for example, you just don't take drugs when you want to stop. But when you have an eating disorder, you have to eat.
Yep.
So you're confronted with sort of the bane of your existence every day. So it's difficult. It's still a struggle, but it's a struggle that I am up for, and I just keep working every day.
Well, Lisa, it sounds like you're in a good place, and we're grateful that you called into Radio Times.
Thank you so much, and thanks for covering this topic. No,
take care. So Lisa makes a number of important points. First of all, we have to eat, and that's probably one of the more difficult challenges of somebody who is trying to recover. Would you like to address that, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And I hear this a lot. There's sort of this wish, I think, sometimes that I wish I could just walk away from food the way, you know, an addict can walk away from drugs and alcohol. And that's not the case. And treatment, you know, we know at Renfrew, treatment is so important to have the structure and supervision around mealtime, to bring in family, to help learn how to support them differently. A lot of things are going very wrong at the dinner table. And I think parents and family want to support. They don't always know how, and they're not really doing and saying the right things. Good treatment really involves how do you manage mealtime, and how do you get the support you need from the people who are around you during it?
And Rebecca, is treatment easy to access? Lisa, you kind of indicated that it's not always easy to get good treatment.
Yeah, no, it's not easy to access at all. I think in our region, we're lucky to have many reputable centers right around here. But I think that, first of all, because of the difficulties we've heard from some of the people that have called in, of just accessing care to begin with and starting with their primary care physician, that's the first point that things can be difficult if their PCP doesn't recognize that there's a real issue. And then there are also really large geographic swaths of places in the United States who don't have any certified specialists, let alone a center or a program. So it really can be difficult. There are certainly movements to try to make things more disseminatable across the country, and lots of places are working on that. I think, you know, to tag team off of what Sam was talking about with food as well, I think that the other thing that we have to really try to do, and early intervention is such a big piece of this because these are brain disorders, but they are treatable. And we really can see full remission and full recovery as long as we intervene early and aggressively. And getting to a healthy weight is a huge part of that. And retraining people's brains by exposing them to lots of different foods in lots of different ways and lots of different places, that's a really important piece of it as well.
All right. Let's take a look at some other populations as well. The Latino community, at least one article I'd read, seemed to indicate that eating disorders are on the rise in this particular community. And communities, there are a number of different cultures, and perhaps even more so within the white community. Does this correspond again to what you might be seeing, Sam, Samantha?
Yeah, certainly. I think in general, things are on the rise. Earlier onset, we're seeing, and I think just the medical acuity is changing. And you know, I'm not sure if it means more people are coming forward and more people are being diagnosed properly. It's hard to say, or if this is actually a real increase that more people are just developing it. And is that because of culture? What is that all about? We're not sure. It's hard to say.
Well, let's take a look at United States culture kind of across all groups. We have a comment from Reggie who asks, is there something unique to wealthy Western countries that causes this? I'm from the Caribbean. I can't imagine this being a problem there.
Well, we have seen people from, and I mean, there are studies that have shown that there are eating disorders in almost every country, actually globally. So certainly they happen, or at least are recognized more frequently in the Western countries. But I don't think they're exclusive to those. So I want to be cautious about that. I don't think we know why. You know, I think the pervasive thought is that the thin ideal is more pervasive here. But I'm not sure that research has actually held that up. So I think we really don't actually know.
Are they on the rise, eating disorders? Or is it just that we're seeing more people, as you said a moment ago, Samantha, that might be recognizing it and stepping forward?
They seem to be on the rise. And again, it's hard to say, but that seems to be the case. And it's really hard to say. I think, of course, you know, as Rebecca said, this is a brain disorder. I do think media and culture play a big role. And what we do know is that the more assimilated someone is in this culture, the more likely they are to sort of develop these issues. There have been studies about that. We need to pay attention to what we're exposing ourselves to, the messages in magazines, TVs, and challenging things that are really not promoting positive body image or promoting some kind of unhealthy, unbalanced diet, exercise, that sort of thing.
What about young people and images they see on social media? Rebecca Peebles.
Well, so social media can definitely be a challenge to navigate for teens in general, young people in general, across all populations. But certainly if you have any body image disturbances, there are certainly some pros to the fact that if you think about the fact that, you know, 60 to 80% of people who are thought to have eating disorders don't actually ever get access to care, then the pros of social media are that they can at least find support online with people, ideally access recovery-oriented content and help themselves out of the illness. Unfortunately, what also can happen is that the majority of sites that focus in don't just have recovery-oriented content and have a lot of harmful content. And that can definitely propagate risk online, for sure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whereas when I was growing up, if you wanted to learn about eating disorder behaviors from people your age, you had to do that on a sleepover, in a locker room. You had to talk to kids in person. If you want to learn about it now, all a young person has to do is go online and Google.
So among Asian cultures, again, this is from some of the research that I was reading for this show, a very thin body type tends to be the ideal. Do you find that eating disorders, again, are common in some of the Asian communities in this country? Rebecca Peebles?
We've definitely always seen a high prevalence in Asian communities. Although I'm not sure it's any higher than, the Latino communities that we work with, African-American, LGBTQ, and male, the one difference is that it does seem like there are perhaps more females that are susceptible to these than males, but not by the ratios classically thought. So we used to think it was 10 to 1 female to male. Now we think it's more like maybe 3 to 2.
Really?
And certainly in kids, no fewer than 6 to 1. So they're certainly more common than we thought in males. So, it's hard to know. I do think, but certainly I've seen many Asian patients. I've had many Asian colleagues. Like, certainly this happens. Absolutely.
So again, this goes against the ideal, you know, the picture at least that most of us have in the back of our minds of a skinny white girl who is dealing with an eating disorder. Do you find that there's increasing knowledge among medical professionals across the board that other communities, other young people might be dealing with eating disorders, an increasing awareness that might lead to more diagnoses? Or is there a lot of work that needs to be done as far as awareness is concerned among the medical community?
That's a great question. I like to think that we're all kind of broadening our perspective. The Renfrew conference just happened and we focused on diversity and eating disorders. Gail Brooks gave a beautiful talk, Shining the Light on Marginalized Populations. So Renfrew, we're trying to do what we can to educate mental health professionals, any really practitioner that might come in contact with someone who might be struggling. So my hope is that we're doing our part and there's work to be done. Mm-hmm. And even just being on the show, I'm so grateful that we're able to talk about this here. And I hope that we continue to do this.
Well, we're happy to have you both here. And also, too, we're talking about the medical health profession. How about schools, you know, other places where there's access, young people have access?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, awareness is increasing, but there's still certainly a gap. you know, and there's a knowledge gap. There's even a knowledge gap among professionals. I think just like we've been talking about classic populations, there are also often people are biased toward thinking about a classic set of symptoms that someone has to really verbalize. I wish to lose weight. I am terrified of gaining weight. Things like that. When really many patients, particularly the younger they get, and we see kids as young as 5 or 6 with these illnesses, the younger they get, the less they can connect those dots. And all they know is that they don't want to eat. And they don't really often know why. And then when they start to gain weight, they get very distressed, but they can't verbalize why. So the newer criteria for eating disorders published in 2013 acknowledge that there are behavioral criteria that can substitute for what we used to think of as only cognitive criteria, which I already mentioned. So if someone, you know, says that they want to gain weight and that they're not afraid of gaining and that they have no interest in losing weight, but they skip lunch every day, they run around their track, they you know, throw away their food. Those are behavioral criteria that no matter what they're saying can qualify them for these diagnoses.
What are the consequences of not being diagnosed? Samantha?
Not being diagnosed, I think it sets you up to not really get the treatment that you need. PCP might refer you in a different direction, thinking maybe this is anxiety or maybe this is trauma or whatever that may be, and we're not really addressing the root of the issue. So I think
it'd be dangerous not to be diagnosed.
Absolutely.
And even deadly.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the deadliest psychiatric disorder in the DSM-5. That's a reality. And left untreated, people die from this. And early intervention, and as Rebecca said, aggressive intervention early on is key. And we need to be able to identify it when it's happening. And the behaviors aren't so obvious all the time. They can be really subtle. And not everyone fits neatly into a category, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder. But there are still behaviors at play that are putting them, putting their health at risk and compromising their well-being.
All right, we'll talk some more about that in just a moment. Up against a break here on Radio Times. Samantha DiCaro is Assistant Clinical Director at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia. Rebecca Peebles is Adolescent Medicine Specialist and Co-Director of the Eating Disorder Assessment and Treatment Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we're taking your calls at 888-477-9499. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, joined this hour by Rebecca Peebles, Adolescent Medicine Specialist and Co-Director of the Eating Disorder Assessment and Treatment Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also, Samantha DiCaro, Assistant Clinical Director at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia. And this hour, we're taking a look at eating disorders, but also eating disorders in various populations, Hispanic, LGBTQ, African-American, American, Asian, those populations that are not necessarily recognized by medical professionals, you know, as having folks who have to deal with eating disorders, who are suffering from eating disorders. And before we get through this hour, let's take a look at LGBTQ youth. And according to the National Eating Disorders Association, research into this population is still limited, but there is some which indicates that as early as age 12, gay, lesbian, and bisexual teens are at higher risk for binge eating and purging than their heterosexual peers. Any thoughts as to why, Samantha?
Sure. I mean, not only are they under the same pressures, I think, that their heterosexual counterparts are under, but there's the intersectionality of, you know, being a marginalized population. They might be from a family who doesn't believe that they should be a certain sexual orientation or they should be a certain gender, or religion might play a role and cause a lot of conflict for them. And so I think the eating disorder sometimes serves a function to help cope with those kind of stressors. Discrimination, the threat of violence, the threat of harassment. These are daily microaggressions that this population has to encounter every single day. And so we do see frequently eating disorders kind of playing a role sort of as a strategy to help cope. And it's a maladaptive strategy, but in some way it does help distract or help soothe some of the really painful emotions that can come from being part of a marginalized population.
And Rebecca Peebles, so in your opinion, does the risk go up for young people whose body experience might be confusing or troubling or even distressing?
I mean, within those populations, is that what we're talking about? Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think we know that non-heterosexual youth are at higher risk for eating disorders from the very limited data that we have. And it's absolutely true that we need more. Transgender youth also seem to be at higher risk for disordered eating behaviors, although there haven't been great large-scale studies on transgender youth for eating disorder diagnoses. And you know, for at least for trans kids, I think there's a lot of body discomfort to begin with. I mean, a body image issues in the sense that they feel like they're in the wrong body. And so losing weight for someone who is genetically female may feel actually like, you know, helpful in a sense because they are getting rid of breast tissue and things like that that can really make them feel potentially more comfortable and can lead them, if they're at risk for getting an eating disorder genetically and neurobiologically, as we talked about before, can sort of lead them down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick clarification. Is there a difference between disordered eating and eating disorders? Does one perhaps lead to the other?
Yeah, so there is a difference. I mean, disordered eating it's dangerous, and I think there are many people who dabble in disordered eating or engage in it frequently without actually meeting criteria for a psychiatric diagnosis like an eating disorder. But disordered eating can certainly trigger on an eating disorder for someone who has vulnerabilities that are already in place, such as biologically, culturally, psychologically. So,
what's an example of disordered eating?
I think, you know, skipping meals or maybe even deciding that certain foods are forbidden, extreme dieting, all of those things can be considered disordered if you're really not giving your body what it needs and providing your body with the nutrients that it needs to function optimally. And so I think lots of people dabble because there's a lot of information out there that is pretty dangerous around how many calories we should have a day, how much we should be exercising, how much we should even weigh. And I think because of all of the info out there, people are making decisions that are actually harming their health.
And when it crosses a line from dabbling into something more continuous, then perhaps you're getting into eating disorder territory.
Yeah, when it starts affecting your health in multiple domains, you know, so it's affecting your medical health, it's affecting how you're able to interact with peers, it's affecting how your performance is in different social domains, and it's more of a pervasive, constant thought process, then that's usually when we're sort of calling it an eating disorder. But we're concerned about those behaviors across the spectrum, for sure.
All right, back to the phones. Beth in Lansdale, you are live on Radio Times with us. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. I'm the mother of two boys who were diagnosed when they were in elementary school. It was a long and arduous process to determine their diagnosis and find treatment. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about is treatment of boys is limited. Many of the programs, even in the Philadelphia area, are limited to just girls, and that's basically eliminating access to 50% of the population, in my case, two of my three boys. We did find great treatment and have been successful, although we're dealing with a relapse now. But it is there's a lot of barriers for boys, and that's really one I want to talk about, as well as just identification at the primary care level. They are often, they tend to want to see it as something else,
so,
especially if it's just because of them being boys.
So you found, Beth, when you were at the
diagnosis,
I'm sorry.
They still try and make it into something else.
So I'm sorry. So when you would take your children to the primary physician, there was perhaps not a sense that this could happen to boys? Or get into
a
little bit more for us, if you
they
would.
They were looking at a lot of different options and were very slow to say this is what it was. And even when we had the diagnosis, they would still kind of say, well, you're doing just fine, even though they were at a 30th percentile BMI, which is another issue of looking at BMIs, even though they'd always been in 90s and 95th percentile. Well, you're still in a healthy weight, so that's the good news. And I felt as if they weren't really aware of the severity of what was going on.
Yeah. How are you doing as a parent?
Shout out to the parents out there, by the way. It's a lot. It's a 24-hour, 7-day a week. You don't get any time off. You're constantly on guard. But it's something that it's my full-time job now to make sure my kids are healthy, who are now in middle school and high school.
Well, Beth, we thank you very much for sharing your difficult journey with us here at Radio Times, and our best to you.
Thank you.
All right, take care. So not only it's the kids, but you've got to have support for families too. Is that provided is part of treatment?
Yes, we run a family-based treatment program, so families are involved from the get-go at all stages of treatment, because we believe the parents are their kids' best allies in getting better, and our best allies in figuring out how to get their kids better. So we really, I mean, unless someone is going to get a parent transplant, which is very rare and usually not indicated, we want to work with parents.
And do you find there's more, again, more knowledge that boys and young men and perhaps even older men are afflicted with eating disorders as well?
I definitely agree with what Beth was saying. I mean, I think that it's a challenge in that I think a lot of primary care, well, first of all, many males do present a little bit differently. There is more stigma. They may not speak up as much about their symptoms. They also more frequently are at a higher BMI at presentation. So PCPs don't always notice until they're much further along in their illness. They will also get many more medical workups and take longer to present for care. And then, as she mentioned, there are fewer programs that treat them. So it's hard all the way around. But I think that, you know, guys, definitely there's a lot of hope for them in treatment. There, we can achieve full remission for them as well. But we do need to get them into care for sure.
And again, as a parent or caregiver, what are the signs that your child might be heading into trouble? And B, how do you approach that young person? Can't be easy, mm-hmm. I imagine. Samantha?
No, I think the signs are not always obvious. You can't just look at someone. It's not the signs. A lot of the symptoms are secretive. So, you know, if there is binging and purging, sometimes that's happening in private. So that can be hard to catch. And there's lying that happens to sort of protect the eating disorder. You know, a parent asked, did you eat dinner? Oh, yeah, I ate at my friend's house. And, you know, meanwhile, maybe the child has been restricting all day. So it's tough. I think some of the signs that to look out for are really, you know, isolating, kind of pulling away from friends and family, not doing so well in school, trouble concentrating, trouble with attention, irritability. So those are signs that aren't so obvious, but they can point in that direction, and you can start asking different questions and monitoring to see if maybe some other things are going on with food and weight.
And again, weight might not always be a hallmark or something to look for, Rebecca Peebles.
That's right. About 40% of the patients that present to us have a history of previous overweight or higher growth curve presentations. And those kids usually present in a normal weight range, but they've lost a dangerous amount of weight in a short amount of time in a dangerous way. And so they're quite ill at presentation, but they don't look ill on a growth curve. They do look ill when you look at them because they look like they're at a weight that doesn't look right for them. Mm. But for a physician who isn't experienced with this, it would be hard to pick it up.
And if you were going to have an opening conversation with a young person, Rebecca Peebles, what would the first words out of your mouth be if you were going to try to ask a person about this very personal issue?
You know, I think first and foremost, I want to hear from the whole family about, because as you know, as we've been discussing, early symptoms are often best noticed by peers and parents. And so I want to sort of hear the whole picture. And then when I'm speaking to the young person, including from the young person themselves, when I'm speaking to the young person, then I want to sort of tie that all in and sort of go in and say, you know, listen, I'm concerned, and here are my concerns. You know, from a physical perspective, here are my concerns. From a behavioral perspective, here are my concerns. And I want to try to have an honest conversation about it. And I think shooting straight sort of is usually the best option. You know, beating around the bush doesn't really get anywhere. I think kids are often relieved to discuss this.
That's a good narrative for caregivers as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Okay. Let's try to get a couple more calls in. Katie in Ardmore, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
So I had 2 points that I wanted to hear you address. One is I myself had an eating disorder in my 20s. It probably wasn't like a total direct case. I ate. I just didn't eat enough, and I was completely obsessed with what I was eating, and I overexercised. So now I'm raising a daughter, and I would like, you know, our message at home is always healthy and strong. And she is definitely, she's 9, and she's always been very strong and very athletic, and she's built, and she's strong, and she doesn't look like a waif, which at 4 and 5, a lot of little girls around her looked incredibly tiny and skinny. And so my one problem I had is that our pediatrician would constantly give us, in her checkups, say things to her about her BMI not being, you know, being at whatever the phrase is, that she was in danger of being obese or something like that. And they would give her sometimes a talk about, well, how many sweets do you eat a day? And to be honest, she's totally fine and healthy, and she's lucky she grows up in a home where we have an emphasis on healthy foods. The second part of my question or comments is the language that we as parents use to girls, because I think we're not always conscious, you know, beyond trying to combat the media, which is bombarding our kids with these images of unattainable, you know, body weights. We at home sometimes are saying things, you know, I hear other mothers talk about themselves not looking fat or feeling fat or needing to be on a diet. And the messages that those that send to our girls, I'm also conscious of having a kid who's on a really skinny side and saying to him, like my other son, you know, you need to eat, you need to get some meat on those bones. And my daughter, I said that to him once, and my daughter said, well, I don't need to have meat on my bones. So just being really conscious of the language we use and how we might inadvertently even be putting too much pressure on appearance and weight.
Katie, thank you so much for the call. Two really important points to make as we wrap up this hour of Radio Times. First of all, the conversation, the language we use, some guidance. Samantha DeCaro.
Sure. And I think it's, I want to thank this parent for calling in, because I think that parents are such powerful role models, and to be kind of self-reflecting this way is just really refreshing to hear. I think that parents are, I mean, being a role model means paying attention to the way you talk about your own body, the way you talk about the bodies of others, modeling balanced eating and regular eating. And I think not focusing on appearance and understanding that health comes in a variety of shapes and sizes. And I think that's challenging when doctors are giving different messages, because we don't know what this child's set point is, and they could be perfectly healthy at the set point that they are at. And so so I think it's really important to be a role model and focus on what the body can do. You know, running, jumping, climbing, swimming, and instead of focusing on what the body looks like.
So, Rebecca Peebles, it can be kind of hard to maybe challenge your pediatrician. They are people who've been through medical school. You may have a really good relationship with them, but it sounds as if the caller was, you know, not pleased with the with what she was being told about her child. So, in that case, what do you recommend?
Yes. I mean, well, first of all, we're certainly trying to increase awareness among pediatricians, but that's going to be the longer play, right? You know, and I think that in the acute situation, I think the first thing is to be honest, is to call the pediatrician or stop them before they come in the room, like ask the nurse to talk to them first and say that you don't want weight discussed with your child, that this has been discussed in a way that you're uncomfortable with, and it's important for it to change. If the pediatrician doesn't listen, then I think, honestly, sometimes you have to change pediatricians, because it's not okay to have those messages.
And to wrap up, if you think there's anything amiss as a parent or caregiver, regardless of the community in which you live, make that call.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Rebecca Peebles, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Rebecca Peebles is adolescent medicine specialist and co-director of the Eating Disorder Assessment and Treatment Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Samantha DeCaro, thanks so much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Samantha DeCaro is assistant clinical director at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia. And as always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page and our podcasts. Quick and easy to do. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.